We're holding in gets in on page eight, at the bottom of his test. Like we learned about yesterday, a good part, most of this perek and most of the following perek talk about various takonas that the Chachamim made mipnei tikkun ha'olam in order for society to function well. One of them had to do with a get, which is what it's doing in this Masechta, but the rest of them are on other topics. So one of the famous takonis that the Chachamim made, Mipnei Tikkun Olam, is the concept of a prusbul. The Mishnah in Shavuos mentions that Hillel HaZaken saw that people are reluctant to lend money before Shemitah, and that would be, and with that, they're being over on an Issur D'Oraisa, which specifically warns not to do that. So therefore, he came up with the concept of a prusbul, that this way a person will be able to collect his debts after Shemitah. Really, actually, you have. It's based on a concept, D'oraisa, which is that if a person before Shemitah gives over, before the end of Shemitah, whatever, gives over his actual loan documents to Beis Din and gives it to them to collect, then it's not Meshamet. It only because Shemitah applies only to private people. Basically, what Hillel did is you don't have to give over the actual loan document, the actual shtaris themselves to Beis Din. It's enough that you write out a shtar prusbul, or even nowadays, we don't even necessarily write out a shtar. We just say it verbally, whatever, and it's considered to be in Beis Din's possession, all of the chovis, and then they can and we're telling them that you can collect it on our behalf. Well, so the Gemara has a long sugya on the ins and outs of it. And at one point, Shmuel says, the whole concept of a prusbul, he says, is ulbana de dayoni. So which the Gemara deals with the question, what does ulbana mean? It's the ulbana of the dayonim. So the Gemara says that has two possible meanings. Ulbana can mean something chutzpahdik of the dayonim to do, that we should take, after all, a din in the mitzvah in the Torah of shmitas ksafim and override it using such a weak mechanism. So fine, Hillel in his times had to make a takana. For that purpose, Shmuel is saying it's not necessarily that we should be doing it that way for all time. And Shmuel says that if I had the ability, I would be mevatel the whole concept. So that's one possibility. The Gemara says that ulbana can mean a chutzpahdik thing. The other possibility, or shameful thing, whatever. The other possibility is it can mean something of convenience, meaning, in other words, it was made really only for the convenience of the dayanim, because otherwise, come the end of Shemitah, they're going to have a line of people coming to give them their shtaris, and therefore, so that for their convenience, the Chachamim, Hillel, and his Beis Din made this takana, but nevertheless, Shmuel says maybe it's not really so necessary. So the Gemara says, well, how do we know? What does Shmuel mean with that expression, ulbana de dayoni? So the Gemara brings a proof from, which is here in Ein Yaakov, from a different context in which we find that same shodash ayin lamed vase, and we see that it means chutzpah, or that it means chutzpah, namely omash Shmuel or Ula aluva kala shezinsa b'seich chupasa. What page 8 in Gittin at the bottom. So aluva kala shezinsa b'seich chupasa. How shameful and how chutzpahdik is the kala who commits znus right there in her chuppah? Referring to the Jewish people at Har Sinai. Here we're at the chuppah with Hashem. We just received the Torah, and we're already making an egel. So we see that we see that Shmuel or Ula is using the word aluva to mean chutzpahdik. So therefore, yes, in his expression ulbana de dayoni, he means it's a chutzpah that the dayonim should be doing such a thing on an ongoing basis every Shemitah, arranged for a prusbul. So the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Mori bro de bas Shmuel. Rav Mori, the son of the daughter of Shmuel, said. Now he's called that. Here he's called Rav bro de bas Shmuel. In other places, he's called Rav Mori bar Rochel. Elsewhere, we find what happened was Shmuel's daughters were taken prisoner by goyim. One, maybe more than one of them, was raped by the goy who had captured her. But and she became pregnant from that. Afterwards, this goy actually became a ger. And we find him mentioned here and there in Shas, because his name is Isu Giora. So their son is not considered his son, la halacha, even though biologically he's his son, because he was conceived when his father was still a goy. Therefore, the son grew up to be a distinguished Talmid Chacham in his own right, but therefore the Gemara sometimes calls him Rav Mori bar Rochel after his mother, or other times, like here, it calls him Bro de Bas Shmuel to trace his yichus back to his chosh of a grandfather Shmuel. Anyway, he says, "Mikra." Where's a pasuk that we see that where we see that that concept expressed of how chutzpahdik and shameful it was for the Jewish people to do such a thing? In Shir HaShirim, there's a pasuk, "Ad Shamelech b'Mesibay," while the king was still at his banquet, "Nudi Nosan Reichai," my nerd, which is a spice like you have in the Ketores, Shibboleth nerd, "Nosan Reichai," gave away its fragrance. Rashi explains that nosan, literally you would think it means gave as in gave forth, but no, it means here it like it abandoned, it gave up its fragrance. As we find sometimes the word nosan means to let go. So we see that we see that Shlomo in this pasuk is expressing the same point. Yehu Hashem is still at his banquet with us at Har Sinai, and already my fragrance, my nerd, already abandoned my spices, abandoned their fragrance, and were not what they were supposed to be anymore. Omar Rava, but Rava says, Adayin chavivusa hu gabon. Nevertheless, you see that. Nevertheless, you see how precious we still are to Hashem, that even though the Pasuk is mentioning this point about how badly we messed up with the Chet Egel, nevertheless, Hashem expresses in this Pasuk his love for us, d'chtiv nosan v'leksiv isriach. Because after all, it doesn't openly say that the nerd went bad and smelled bad, which it could have said. Instead, it uses the word nosan, which, yeah, I mean, he will understand the word nosan to mean that it gave it up, that it no longer had it. But still, instead of using something more openly like hisriach, instead it uses a nicer word like nosan, which we could also understand to mean it gave forth its fragrance in the positive sense. Tosfos actually points out, I mean, it wouldn't be necessarily saying hisriach. The Torah does try to use nice language when possible, but at least it didn't have to say nosan. It could have said ozav, which would more clearly mean that it gave away its fragrance, and instead it uses the word nosan, which can have a double meaning. It can mean to give forth, or it can mean to give up. So we see, in other words, that the word aluva means chutzpahdik, means an embarrassment and a chutzpah. Marsha, by the way, deals with the technicalities of it. I mean, really, at this when it comes to Bnei Noach, then when it comes to Bnei Noach, the akala in the chuppah, they don't really have among Bnei Noach the concept of marriage. The Gemara discusses in Sanhedrin, they don't really have a concept of kiddushin or chuppah. There's only when they first had relations, then she's considered married. And here they hadn't, so to speak, consummated the marriage yet between Hashem and the Jewish people. But it's Moshe is still on the mountain after all. Is only like kiddushin. So, but nevertheless, still, and it was a shameful thing for the Jewish people to be doing it at a time like that. So the Gemara brings now another statement that also uses the Shurdash Ayin Lamed Vez, that also referring to chutzpah and to insults and embarrassment. Tanan Abanan Hanei Lovim Ve'enim Olvin, people who are embarrassed by others, who are insulted by others. Ve'enim Olvin, but they don't insult back. So again, we're seeing that the word olav means to insult or to be chutzpahdik. So other people are chutzpahdik to them, and they're not chutzpahdik back. Shemim chepasim ve'en meshivim. They hear people shaming them, and they don't respond back. Oisim me'ava. They do things for out of love for Hashem. They do mitzvahs out of love of Hashem. Usmeichim biyisurim. Not, in other words, not for the sake of schar and not because of fear of punishment. Usmeichim biyisurim. And they're happy for the yisurim that they get because they realize that these help clean up their averus. Aleihem akosav omer. On such people, the pasuk says, "Va'oyhavav katzeis Hashemish begvurasai." Those who love Hashem are like the sun when it comes forth in its full strength. So here, Bepashtus, the Gemara is bringing this in again because it's another example of the Shurdash Ayin Lamed Vez, also meaning insult or chutzpah, just like we had with the regarding the Prusbel, and just like we have regarding the Jewish people and the Chet Egel. So the connection between all these midas, Marsha points out that all of these are part of oyhavav. All of these are aspects of loving Hashem. When a person doesn't respond in kind to people who insult him, they insult him and he doesn't insult him back, then it must mean he's ohuv labrius. People love him. People love a person with good midas like that, and therefore automatically, as it says in Pirkei Avos, anybody that ruach habrius noichay menu, that people like him, then Hashem also likes him. So therefore, then he's oisin me'ava. Exactly what it sounds like. He's acting, he's doing mitzvahs out of love of Hashem and not for any reward. Smechem b'yisurim is also that he accepts the yisurim with love. So therefore, so all of those things go into the definition of v'oyavav. And then Marsha goes on to say, the point is, just like the sun has an effect on the entire world, the same way, like we have in the Pasuk, in Kapitel Yud Tes of Tilim, Ve'en Nistar Mechamose, nothing can hide from the sun's heat, the same way such a person has dominion over everything in the world. There's a lot of other points that various Mephoshim talk about different angles within this. The Rif explains that the Rif over here explains that it's like this. Hanei lovim ve'enim ovin would mean that they don't answer back with insults. Means they don't respond with anything at all. Now, they don't necessarily have to respond with an insult, but after all, a person is insulted or treated badly or whatever, they could, after all, respond back, or what do you want from me? That kind of thing. So, he doesn't even do that. He doesn't try to justify himself or whatever. He just accepts it quietly. And then that he accepts it with love, and he's happy with the yisurim because he realizes again that these yisurim will help be a kapara for him. In fact, the Rif says the context of this pasuk is at the end of the shira of Devorah, after she and Barak had beaten Sisera and his army. She said a whole shira, which we have as the Haftarah of Parshas Peshalach. We have the whole story and the song as the Haftarah of Parshas Peshalach, and she finishes off the song with these words. The Rif says over here, you think about it, Barak was kind of in that situation. He was kind of he got the short end of the stick over here. That here he's supposed to be the leader of the victory, but in fact the victory is credited more to Devorah and to Yoel than it is to him. So therefore, he's an example of he's being treated a little disrespectfully, and he doesn't answer back, and he doesn't say, wait, I deserve more credit than I really got. So she puts at the end of the shira, she puts in this compliment to him that he really personifies these midas. There's a lot of points that various Mephoshim talk about why Dafka, the comparison to the sun. There's an interesting thing from the Sefer Akedas Yitzchak that gives a couple of reasons behind it. One of them is, when you have an eclipse, when you have a solar eclipse, the moon is blocking the sun's light from us. The sun ought to be insulted. My job is to give light to the world, and here you're getting in my way. And what are you, thousands of times smaller than I am? What are you doing hooning in over here? But it doesn't. It goes in and does its thing. It still gives light to the moon, and it still eventually, after the eclipse is over, it continues to give light to us. So therefore, that represents this person who acts like this. There's also, for example, there's the idea. We know famously that the moon complained, it's impossible that I and the sun should be the same size. Like, he wants the sun to be diminished in size, and instead Hashem diminished the moon. So again, therefore, the sun is hearing the moon complain and doesn't answer back and doesn't say anything. So therefore, a person who is like that also deserves to be compared to the sun and to have the intensity and the strength of the sun. It's brought, by the way, in Sfarim, that it's brought that a person who's like that, who's insulted and doesn't respond back, has tremendous power, in particular, to give brachas. They tell a story involving a couple who, for many years, weren't having children. They went to some gadol. I think it was Reb Chaim Kanevsky, but I don't remember for sure. But anyway, he told them, find such a person where they're insulted and they don't respond back, and ask them for a bracha. And it's not so easy to find such a person, but eventually they found and asked for a bracha, and sure enough, the next year they had a baby. The Gemara continues. My prusbul. Why do we call the stakana of getting back to the prusbul now? Why do we call it prusbul? Amar Rav Chista prus buli ubuti. It's a prus, which means a takana. Further on, the Gemara it meant, which is not here in Ein Yaakov, it mentions that Rava one time heard somebody speaking a foreign language, Greek, and he asked him in his language, "What does prus mean?" And the guy said it means like the fixing up, the takana of the matter. So it's a prus. That's a takana buli ubuti. For the buli and the buti, which the Gemara is going to explain, means the rich and the poor. Buli elu ashirim. The word buli refers to the rich people. Now, it's not because in English you have the word bully and rich people bully people, maybe, but that's not the reason. In Greek, actually, the word bulle means something like the noblemen, the aristocrats or whatever. So therefore, so it comes to mean the rich people. Dichtiv, as we find a pasuk in the Torah, in Parshas Bechukosai, Hashem says, "V'shavarti es go'un uzkem, I will break the height of your strength." V'toni Rabbi Yosef, "El bulois shebi Yehuda." Rabbi Yosef explained that that meant the rich people in Yehuda, where until now they were helping support the people. We're going to have soon, in the next day or two, we're going to start the Agadta about the Churban, where you have the story of the three famous rich people in Yerushalayim, Nachdimin Ben Gurion, and Kalbus Ben Kalbus Savua, and Ben Sitzes HaKesses, who were ready to supply Yerushalayim with food for a multi-year siege, and then their power was broken, and in the end, there was a siege and there was a Churban. So we see that the word Bulois means rich people. Buti Elohim, and the word buti refers to the poor people. Dichtiv havet tavitenu, as the pasuk says, you should lend a fellow yid money, and who is it that usually borrows money? Is a poor person. So ha'avet, you have the vase and the test over there. So therefore, buti means the poor people. So in short, we call the takana prusbul for short, but the full name of it is prusbuli or buti, which means the takana for the rich and for the poor. it benefits both of them. The rich person is that way not over on the Aveda and the Torah of failing to lend a fellow yid money before Shemitah, and he also gains that he's going to be able to collect his loan after Shemitah, and the poor person gains because now people are willing to lend him money even close to Shemitah, knowing that they're going to be able to be paid back. Marsha points out also, you know, you have really the, it's also kind of a play on words, because lamed and tes are both, you pronounce lamed and tes, both of them, you press your tongue against your teeth or against the ridge just above your teeth. So therefore, those two letters, in other words, come from the same, it's called the same moitza peh, they come from the same point of articulation in the mouth. And therefore, so we wanted a word that, that where you have almost the same word for rich and poor. So again, the prusbul benefits both of them. As opposed to, Marsha says, by the way, what happened was, when we say, v'shavartis go'inuz ch'me'elu b'loris shub Yehuda, we're not necessarily referring to the three rich people of Yerushalayim, because they were balei tzedakah. Rather, we're referring to other rich people who refused to lend money, and therefore their power eventually got broken. But again, now with a prusbul, they're more willing to lend money. Further on in the perek, it starts talking about dinim of avodim knanim. There's a number of takonis that the chachamim made, also in connection with an eved knani and a shivcha knanis, also mepnei tikkun olam, various things. So that leads the Gemara into a long discussion about various dinim of avodim knanim. But it has a connection with the Masechta anyway, because like this, when you free an eved knani, one way of doing it is with a shtar, and that shtar has certain similarities in halacha to a get that's given to a woman. So that's another reason why it comes up in this Masechta, and this area over here with several blot that the Gemara spends on it is one of the major places in the Gemara where it talks about all the dinim of avodim knanim. Anyway, one thing it mentions in the course of the discussion is that there's a mitzvah essay in the Torah to keep an eved knani forever and implicitly therefore not to free him. La'olam behem ta'avoidu, the pasuk says you should always keep an eved knani working for you, and therefore the Gemara says if a person frees an eved knani, then he's over on a mitzvah essay. Now, the Gemara mentions there are certain exceptions, sometimes when it is a mitzvah to do it. One example it gives is, for example, one time Rabbi Eliezer comes to Shul together with his Eved. He finds there isn't a minion, so he frees his Eved, and now he can count towards the minion. If only it were so easy nowadays to make a minion, sometimes when we need it here in Shul, but anyway. So in this connection, the Gemara brings the following piece. Omar Rava or Rabba, Bahani Tlas Mili Nachsi Balabatim Nechseim. Because of the following three things that Balabatim do, they end up losing their wealth. The first one, Demapki Avdayu Lecherusa. The first one is because they free their avodim Knanim. So therefore, so again, they're being over on this mitzvah saseh. Or deciding Nechsayu B'Shabza. The second thing is because they look at their nechosim, they look at their fields on Shabbos to see what they need to do. Now, mi'ikra din, it's allowed. You're not allowed to speak about business or about weekdayish things on Shabbos, but you're allowed to think about it, technically. Nevertheless, it's not the right thing to do. It's like he's figuring, I have off work on Shabbos anyhow, so I may as well take a look at my field and start planning mentally for what I'm going to do with it after Shabbos. So now, Rabba is saying that causes them to eventually lose their wealth. And the third one is udekavis or desayu b'shabsa beiden beimedrusha. The third one is that they make their suda on Shabbos at the time when the chacham is darshaning in the beis medrash. They would have public drushas on Shabbos, where they would teach people Torah. So these people make their suda. They time their suda for exactly that time, where they should be doing it earlier or later. So what's the connection? How do these things davka cause them to lose their wealth? So Marsha explains, because it's like this: in the case of the avodim, in the case of the eved. Each one of them, then he's being over on something. When he frees his Eved, it shows that he himself is taking away from his Nechosim. He himself has property that Hashem gave him, including an Eved, and he goes and voluntarily frees him for no good reason. So it's like he's showing that I don't really need my wealth. As far as looking over his nechosim on Shabbos, so again, technically he would be allowed to, but nevertheless, he's not going to see a bracha in his nechosim because of that, because he still shouldn't be thinking about it on Shabbos. And Maharsha refers over here to the story in Masechta Shabbos, where you have the opposite of that, a chosid echad who saw a breach in his fence on Shabbos, and for a moment he's thinking what to do about it, and then he catches himself and realizes, wait, I'm not supposed to think about that on Shabbos. And in the end, Hashem rewarded him by having a tzlach bush grow over there and cover up the hole, where also now it gives him a nice source of income. So here, this person is doing the opposite. He's thinking over on Shabbos, what can I do to improve my field and to improve my nechosim after Shabbos? And therefore, that means he's denying himself that bracha. As far as the Suda at the time of the drasha in Shul, so Maharsha refers to the fact that the Gemara tells us in Brachas that the Chassidim Rishonim would spend a lot of time. They made their Torah, they made their learning Torah the primary focus of their day's schedule. And then, okay, you have to go to work, so they would fit that in wherever it fits. This person is doing the opposite. He's acting as though the learning of Torah is less important. So therefore, again, he forfeits that bracha that Hashem would give in the Chassim, and therefore he ends up losing his nechassim. Eitz Yosef points out other points as well, that like this, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that rich people in Bavel are zeicha to their wealth because they honor the Torah, and in other countries because they honor Shabbos. So now these people who are looking over their property on Shabbos are not honoring Shabbos, and the ones who are having their Suda at the time of the drosha in Shul are not honoring the Torah. So different angles like that. Different other mafoshim talk about different possibilities within that of what exactly it is. What exactly these three things have in common. But that's what the Gemara is telling us over here, that these three things are things that cause people to lose their wealth. And the Gemara continues. Rabbi Chiya Ba'aba tells us, in fact, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that shtei mishpachas hoyu b'Yerushalayim, there were two prominent families in Yerushalayim, achas kovas sodasa b'Shabbos. One of them would make their main meal on Shabbos during the time when they're supposed to be in the Beis Medrash. Va'achas kovas sodasa b'erev Shabbos. The other one made their main meal on erev Shabbos. Now Rashi has two explanations. One is that it means they made their main meal Friday night. Now, with that, they're trying to gain that this way they won't be interfering with the time of the Darasha. The problem with that is, lahalacha, the daytime meal of Shabbos is supposed to be nicer than the nighttime meal. The daytime meal of Shabbos, even though we have a lesser kiddush by it, in terms of the actual meal, in terms of the actual food served, it should be more choshev than the nighttime meal, and they weren't doing that. Rashi's second explanation is that they would have a big Suda on Erev Shabbos. They were very rich, and therefore, so every day, including Erev Shabbos, they would have big banquets. The problem is that when you do it Erev Shabbos, then you don't go into Shabbos with an appetite, and therefore it shows a lack of kavod for Shabbos. This past Friday was Purim. We had that issue, which is why we had to have the Suda somewhat earlier than usual in order to avoid that issue and not be going into Shabbos full and not be able to enjoy the Shabbos food. So according to Rashi, that was the problem with the second family, Ushtei and Nekru, and the result was both families became uprooted, both of them lost their wealth and lost their position because they showed a lack of respect for Shabbos or for the or a lack of respect for Shabbos or for the drosha of Torah on Shabbos, as the case may be. Further on, the Gemara spends, as I said, quite a few blot talking about various dinim of an Eved Ivri and of an Eved Knani and a Shifcha Knanis. So at one point, the Gemara mentions the point like this. Now, it's possible to have an Eved or a Shifcha who is chetzye Eved v'chetzye ben chodin. They can be half slave and half free. The obvious way would be if they're owned by two partners and one of them frees his, and one of them frees his half and the other one has not done the same thing. Now we know a yid is not able to do kiddushin with a shifcha knanis. She's out of the whole picture as far as kiddushin are concerned. The only one that the shifcha knanis is allowed to marry and have relations with is an eved ivri, as it talks about at the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. What about now if she's half free? Now you have a din like this. Suppose a man goes to a woman and gives her a pruta and says, "Half of you is mekudesh to me." Does that work? So the Gemara says no, because to say half of you is mekudesh to me implies, and the other half is available to be mekudesh to somebody, to be niskadesh to somebody else, and you can't. A woman can't have two husbands. So therefore, so it's not a valid kiddushin. So now the Gemara says, Dorash Rava Bar Avuna. So Rava Bar Avuna drew an analogy with that, and he darshan, Kashem Shama Kaddish Chatzi Isha Ein Makudeshes. Just as if a man is Makadish half a woman, it doesn't work. The same way when this woman is half slave woman and half free, then it would be impossible to do Kedushin with her. But Rav Chista says to him, "Me dummy, how do you compare it? There's a big difference. Hosam shir b'kinyonai, when it comes to the regular Jewish woman, when he says I'm mekadesh half of you, he's leaving out a part that he could have been mekadesh. He could have been mekadesh all of her, and instead he's mekadesh only half of her. So therefore, you could say it's not effective." But over here, he's being Makadish everything that he can. He can't be Makadish the half of her that's a slave woman, because she's out of the picture as far as Kedushin are concerned. So he's Makadish whatever is available for Kedushin. Why should that be invalid? So the Gemara says that Rabba Bar Avuna accepted the argument. Hoder Uki Rabba Bar Avuna Amora Ilave V'Dorash. Now he set up an Amora in front of him to darshan in public. Now why, for the first time, Marsha points out, it didn't say anything about an Amora. The way it used to work, as we have throughout Shas, is that a Chacham or a Rosh Hashiva or whatever, often when he's giving a Drosha to the public, he wouldn't say it loudly enough for everybody to hear. He would say it quietly and briefly to a Turgamon standing, also known as an Amora, standing next to him, and the Amora would speak out the details more clearly and say it loudly for everybody to hear. So now he set up an Amora because he wanted to make the following announcement. Marsha points out that, first of all, one possibility is that that they would only set up an Amora only when they're darshaning psukim. He was going to quote a posuk and darshan it, so for that kind of thing they would have an Amora, as opposed to before he was just saying a din. Another point, Eitz Yosef makes a point as well, is that he wanted to show everybody publicly that he had made, actually Ion Yaakov says this, that he wanted to show he doesn't care about the fact that he's going to be embarrassed. It's after all more embarrassing that somebody else should say it about him than about himself. So therefore, but he's going to go and darshan publicly that I made a mistake and I'm changing my mind. So he started his drasha with the pasuk, "V'amachshela azos tachas yadecha." The pasuk says, "This stumbling matter is under your hands." The context is that the Navi describes how there's going to come a point where the people of Yerushalayim are going to go over to a person and they're going to say, "You seem to have the qualities of a leader. You should be our leader." The Gemara in Shabbos explains that it means just that. They tell him, "You seem to have the qualities of a Talmud Chacham. Be our Rav. Be our teacher of Torah." And part of what they tell him is "V'amachshela azos tachas yadecha," which means "Ein adam oimen al divrei Torah elim ken nichshol behen." A person only really fully understands a concept of Torah only if he first stumbled over it. So, in other words, the same way Rabba Bar Avuna is saying, because I stumbled, I made a mistake in this halacha. Now I realize the facts. In the pasuk over there, by the way, the guy responds that no, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm not really qualified to be a rav or a talmud chacham at all. But the point is, in other words, that they're using, why they're using the word machshela azos for divrei Torah, that a person says something in Torah. It turns out that he was wrong, and he gets embarrassed for it, and then that motivates him to realize it properly. So they tell him, you are expert in such areas of Torah, so you should be our rav and you should be our teacher of Torah. So now, again, Rabba Bar Avuna is quoting this pasuk to say, I'm in that situation. I went through machshela hazos, and now I'm going to clarify the halacha for everybody. Why is it taka that ein onam oimin al divrei Torah elam ken nichshol behen? Again, there's a variety of explanations among Mefoshim. Among them are the embarrassment itself is a kapara for him, and therefore makes it more possible for him to learn Torah. And there's the fact that since Torah is chokhmoseh ratzonah shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the human mind by derech hateva should not be able to assimilate it, but only when the person feels a sense of bitul is he able to, and this that he stumbled over it when he's publicly embarrassed helps create by him that sense of bitul, and a variety of other reasons why it's often important that a person makes a mistake in something of Torah, and that itself gives him the capability now to understand it so much better. So he says, and he goes on to quote Rav Chista's point that there is a distinction. A man is Makadish half a woman, it doesn't work, but a man is Makadish a chetz yeshiv of a chetz yabaschor, and it does work. And the difference is because in one case he's not being Makadish every part of her that he could have, whereas in this case he is. Further on in the Perek, it continues talking again. We're still talking about things that the Chachamim made takonis mifnei tikkun olam in order for society to function properly. So one of them is the Mishnah mentions about dinim of pidyon shvuyim, that when a person is captured, is captured and taken hostage by goyim, you don't free him for more than he's worth, because that's going to motivate the goyim to do that again and again. This is unfortunately very much in the headlines now. And famously, we know Maharam Rutenberg followed this in practice when he was arrested by the emperor, by the German emperor of that time, and they were raising money to get him out of jail. He refused, and he quoted this, that you can't do that in Pordenas Shvuyin Yos Mekdei Demeyim, because then it's just going to encourage the goyim to do it again and again. It worked, by the way, because the attacker never tried it again, because they realized they didn't get anything, they didn't get the money they were expecting to out of arresting Maharam Rutenberg. Anyway, so the Mishnah also mentions, for the same reason also, Mipnei Tikkun Olam, when you have people who are captured and imprisoned by goyim, you don't try to help them escape. Because then what's going to happen is that then they're going to guard the other ones who are under their control all the harder, and they may even they may torture them or worse. So therefore, better if you can arrange with them to ransom them for a decent amount, then fine. But don't go trying to help them escape, because then they're just going to take it out much worse on the other ones who are there. Also, unfortunately, very negaya now. So the Gemara tells the following story about this point of Jews who were captured by goyim and escaping. Now, you can't necessarily help them escape, but the prisoners themselves are certainly entitled to do whatever they can to escape. So that's borne out in the following story. The Gemara starts off, Binse did Rab Nachman, Rab Nachman's daughters, Bachshin Kidra Biadaihu. They were stirring pots with their bare hands. There would be a pot on the fire, and the contents of the pot are very hot. And they would stir it with their bare hands, and nothing would happen to them. So it seemed like they're tzidkonius. They must be on a tremendously high level of tzidkos that the fire doesn't affect them. But kashalei l'Rab Ilish. But Rab Ilish found it difficult to understand how that could be. He says to himself, "Ksiv." The pasuk says, "Adam echad me'elaf matzasi." I found one man in a thousand. That's an outstanding tzaddik of that kind of level. Ve'isha b'cholayla le'matzasi. But even among that, I couldn't find any women. That there should be women who reach that level of tzidkos is a highly unusual thing. So what do you mean? How even more rare than by men? So he thinks to himself, "Hoika binse de Rab Nachman." Well, here you have the daughters of Rab Nachman, and daughters in the plural, there's more than one. So it seems that it's not such a rare thing. So what is Shlomo talking about? Well, the Gemara says, "Garmelei or Lahu Milsa." This matter caused them the ishtabian that they were taken captive. Marsha explains that's just it. The fact that they were passing themselves off as tzidkonius, and as the Gemara is going to say at the end of the story, they were anything but. That itself caused Hashem caused them to be captured by goyim in order for their true nature to be made known to everybody. So they were taken prisoner by goyim. V'ishtaboy iunami bahadayu, and Reb Ilish was also captured and taken captive together with them. Yoimachad have a Yosef Gabeahu Gavra. One day, a certain man was sitting together with Reb Nachman. This person, I guess, was also a fellow captive over there. To have a yoda belishna ditzpori. This guy knew the language of the birds. He knew when birds are making noises and all. He knew what that signifies. Also uva v'korkori le. All of a sudden, a raven comes and starts calling to him. Omale mai ka omar. So Reb Ilish asks the guy, "What is the raven saying?" Omale. So the man answers, "The raven is saying, Ilish brach, Ilish brach, Ilish, run away, run away." Omar. But Reb Ilish thinks to himself, "I'm not going to follow that." Urva shakrahu. The raven is a liar. We find all the way back by the marble when Noach sent out the raven to check out what's the story. Has the water dried up yet? Then the raven didn't do its job. And then the raven didn't do its job, and it circled around, and it wouldn't whatever. So therefore, so sort of Ilish figures to himself that you can't rely on what a raven is saying. So why do you ask in the first place? One interesting point that Mephoshim say is maybe Fakert. He's thinking to himself, whatever the raven says, I'll do the opposite. So therefore, he wasn't going to listen to it, and he wasn't going to use that as a basis to say that he should run away. But then adahochi osa yona v'kokarya. Then a dove came and was also calling and making and cooing and making noises. Omale maika omra. So again, Rav Elish asks the guy, what is it saying? Omale, and he says the same thing. Elish brach, Omar. So now Rav Elish thinks to himself, Knesset Yisroel ki yona mesila. The Jewish people are compared to a raven. I compared to a dove. Sorry, are compared to a dove. For a number of reasons. A dove is always faithful to its mate, just like we're always faithful to Hashem. A dove, the Gemara mentions in some places, when it's attacked, then it doesn't it fights it fights with its wings, rather it fights or it protects itself with its wings, unlike, in other words, other birds, other birds fight with their claws or whatever. It doesn't. There's a number of points in that. It means that the dove flies away with its wings in the same way, or the all wings are Torah and mitzvah. So there's a variety of reasons why we Jewish people are compared to a dove. So he thinks to himself, therefore he says, I can see that a ness is going to happen to me. Now, Marsha points out, by the way, that it's not that he didn't believe the person when the person first told him that I understand the language of the birds and the raven is making these noises and saying run away. It's not that he's saying I'm afraid that you're a liar. He's just saying that the raven is not a trustworthy bird as opposed to the dove is, as we see also by Noach, that the dove faithfully fulfilled its mission. There's also the point, Mephoshim point out, since as the Gemara is going to go, the Gemara goes on to say that this guy ran away also, then we have to assume the guy is telling the truth, otherwise he wouldn't risk his own life on something that's not true. So it must really be that he understood the language of the birds. Omar, so now Reb Elish thinks to himself, Ezel echze bin se de Reb Nachman, let me first go and check on Reb Nachman's daughters, e kaimen behemunusaihu, if they're still faithful to Yiddishkeit and to their husbands, adrinu, then I should help them escape also and bring them back to their husbands in Nahavda. How's he going to find out? Well, how's he going to find out what's doing with them? Omar, he thinks to himself, Noshi, when it comes to women, kol mili de islahu, whenever they have private things they want to talk about, sadran lahadodi bebeis hakisa, they talk it to one another while they're in the bathroom. In fact, the Gemara mentions in Sanhedrin that at one point Rabbi Yossi made a takana that women should go to the bathroom. Remember, they didn't have bathrooms in their houses. A bathroom would be a latrine or something out in the open field, that they should go in groups of two or more. This way it would avoid a problem of yichud. This way they're going to be talking with one another, and any men who are nearby will hear their voices and he'll realize not to go there, and therefore there won't be a problem of yichud. So now, so he figures the same way. Based on that, then they're going to be talking over there, and therefore I can listen in. He overheard them saying, "Adi Guvrin, these guys, the goyim who took us prisoner, are Guvrin. They're now our husbands." Now, obviously, the captors have been doing whatever they want with them all this time. But in other words, you know, you have in English they have something called Stockholm syndrome, where sometimes, unfortunately, people who are captured by terrorists or by whatever start identifying with them. So now these women are in the same situation. They're thinking of these goyish captors as now these guys are now our husbands. Or Nahavda, Guvrin, and back in Nahavda, we had our old former husbands. Namelo, let's tell the goyim who originally took us prisoner and for now whom we have feelings, let's tell them that they should take us far away. That they should take us far away from here. Inshin, otherwise, our husbands from Nahavda are going to hear that we're in this area, and they're going to ransom us, and we don't want to be ransomed. We'd rather stay here with these bandits. Well, so Rav Elish realizes that obviously they're not faithful to. It's not an onus anymore. Now it's berotzen. So therefore, so there's no sense in trying to get them to come with me. They, at this point, we can't help it. We have to give up on them. Come Orak, so he went, got up to run away. Also, Iuvahu Gavra, and he come Orak. Also, he started going and running away. Iuvahu Gavra, he and this guy who understood the language of the birds. The day Rav Elish was able, Ness happened for him. Over Bamabra, he was able to successfully cross the river. He was able to successfully cross the river, and now he's safely away from the captors, from the bandits. The other guy, the bandits caught up with him and killed him, and Ness didn't happen to him. Whether he was a Yid or a Goy, it doesn't say one way or the other. eventually, ki hadran vasoyan, eventually these women did come back. Marsha points out they didn't come back voluntarily. We just said that they were saying to each other, we'd rather just stay with these bandits. Eventually, apparently, their husbands did find out where they were, and they arranged to ransom them. So now they came back. Omar, so now Rav Elish realizes what was going on all this time. The fact that originally they were stirring those pots with their bare hands is they were doing it through the power of Kishuf, not that they were Tzidkonius. So now he understands. I was wondering how it comes that they're such exceptional Tzidkonius, that they can have an open thing happen like that, that they're impervious to the fire. No, the real reason is because they were accomplishing that through Kishuf. We talked about a day or two ago that Rav Nachman, actually, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, was married to the daughter of the Reish Galusa, who was the governor, the minister of Jewish affairs in Bavel. I don't know, but it's possible that maybe it means, in other words, not always do we find the Reish Galusa were such great people. Maybe that, unfortunately, had a bad effect on the daughters and caused them to go off the derech like that. I don't know if it says anything like that one way or the other, but it's a potential svara. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gu'ula. What is today? You'd test.
Yeah, you'd test other days. You'd test rather.
So La'asid Lavoi, it's the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Malachim that La'asid Lavoi, all the Jewish people will be great chachamim. So what does that mean? That will be great chachamim. It means not just in Torah. It means that all the chachmas will be restored to us. So we won't need the chachmei umas anymore. For example, the Rama mentions in Hilchos Kiddush HaKodesh that all the details he explains over there about how to calculate the positions of the sun and the moon and the phase of the moon and all that necessarily, he says, has to be based on books by Greek astronomers, by Greek and Arab astronomers, because he says the original svarim that were written on that subject by the chachamim from Shevi Yisachar, we don't have them anymore. But now these chokhmas will know them through the Torah, similar to we find a story in Masechta Bechoras where Rabbi Yeshua deduces how long a snake's pregnancy lasts from psukim, unlike the Gemara mentions over there, the goyish scientists of that time who tried to learn that by observation. The real way that we'll know these things, lost and lovely, will be from the Torah itself. Continuing on Erevei Chatzeres. So we've been talking about the whole concept of schiras reshus from a goy. So now, if you have a Yisrael mumer, a yid who unfortunately has converted to another religion, or is mechal Shabbos b'fahesya, and the Alter Rebbe adds, we don't mean, for example, just that he one time was in a hard situation. It was mechal Shabbos. We're talking about a person who's regularly mechal Shabbos. Yesh Omrim, and the Alter Rebbe agrees with this, even if he's only Mechal Shabbos in Yisurim Derabbanan, then for this purpose he's considered like a goy, and you would need schiras reshus from him as well. Whether that applies to nowadays people who don't keep Shabbos because they don't know better in Tinukas and their Tinukas Shenishbu, that I'm not sure about. I think that in general we say that the fact that we say that the Tinukas Shenishbu, we say lechumra, but not lekula. But so that would mean, in other words, over here to say that they're considered like a yid would be a kula, and you don't need tzchiras or shus. But I'm not sure about that point.